Hello, and thanks for listening to Rip the Guts, a podcast about everything. I'm your host, Travis, and let's get talking. So, I realize that saying the podcast is about everything doesn't actually tell you much, but it really is. Of course, the tech companies that allow listeners easier access ask us to categorize ourselves. Are you about news, sports, history, politics, religion? Whatever. This makes things a little awkward in my case, so I guess the most suitable category would be comedy, as existence is the funniest joke after all. To give you a better understanding of what's to come, it's probably useful to explain how we got here. And I'll ask that you hold in your mind that there is a point to all of this. Might meander around a little bit, but, you know, it's going to take some time to get there, but there is a point. So, it all started sometime in the year 224 million or something like that. You see, I engaged in what became a pretty lengthy email correspondence with a woman I just happened to come into contact with. And as I am a shaman, our conversation was largely spiritual and philosophical in nature. So, over the course of the year, we exchanged emails and voice memos went back and forth, and somewhere along the way, the idea to start a podcast emerged. The thinking was that as our conversation was very engaging and meaningful, other people may find it interesting, exploring the human experience through spirituality and philosophy. What's not to like about that? So, over time, we evolved the idea, acquired technology, and laid plans, and right at the very last moment, my would-be co-host could no longer do it. That is Murphy's Law, of course. But despite that, I decided to continue on with the project, and while there are tentative plans to have other people involved in future, for the time being, it will just be me monologuing to you, dearest listener. Okay, so I just mentioned in the introduction that I'm a shaman, and while that's not all that I am or all that I've been, it's a logical starting point for our journey. And you might be asking yourself, what is a shaman? Well, broadly speaking, you can think of a shaman as a nutjob, a wacko, or a person who communes with the ethereal in an effort to increase one's own knowledge and abilities and, at a certain point, is able to assist others with this waking nightmare we call life. In my case, I can say that I pained and suffered for many years in my quest for knowledge, in my quest to unlock consciousness. And at a certain point, that became useful to other people. And so, when the opportunity arose, I applied my knowledge and abilities to assisting others with their journey through time and space, their spiritual evolution. One of the reasons the idea of starting a podcast was quite appealing to me is that I found speaking with the aforementioned woman about my practice to be very cathartic. Instead of just filling the role of shaman, I was also receiving therapy by simply talking about my experiences. Who would have thought? And this is something I've never spoken about openly with anyone before, always operating in the shadows, as I live in a society that doesn't readily accept and even rejects the mystical. So, no surprises that I receive some therapeutic benefit from speaking about it for the first time. And make no mistake, this is not a podcast about me. I won't be harping on my own experiences or anything like that, but things will certainly come up from time to time, and my practice, my experience, serves as the basis for some of the things I'm going to say. And on that note, we've arrived. So a part of my practice as a shaman, part of what I've done, besides the exotic things, is simply speaking with people. You know, much in the way that a priest or clergyman of X, Y, or Z religion would speak with a person offering spiritual guidance and, you know, what is ultimately what I like to call spiritual psychotherapy. And not only do I cover the bigger subjects and serve those deeper spiritual needs, one of my specialties is deprogramming. It's important to note here that while deprogramming, I'm not trying to tell a person anything, not trying to convince them of anything. And my greatest goal when conducting these sessions is to get a person to think for themselves, to understand their thoughts, to understand what their thoughts are, where they come from, help them identify psychic parasites, harmful thought patterns, find the source of destructive behavior, and so on. And just by the way, talking with people represents a decent chunk of my practice, the other chunk being the crazy stuff, the exotic. More on that another time, surely? And of course, this phrasing I've just used is me speaking through my society's lens, as my society and Western society in general would have you believe that this mystical stuff isn't real and doesn't exist and isn't meaningful and means nothing. Infecting the population with ignorance? Not the way I would do it, but then again, I'm not at the top of the pyramid. I also think it's useful for me to stress the fact that I've intentionally kept away from reading any spiritual or religious texts, intentionally kept away from reading any philosophy or weighty tomes on really anything that matters. I made this choice consciously when I was much younger than I am now. You see, I would actually delight whenever I was speaking with someone and they would say to me, oh, that's from Buddhism, or that's what this or that notable intellectual said. It was gratifying to me to be equal to those thinkers or heavy doctrines, and it's telling, I think, the convergence of thought. And what better way to know that you're onto something than building thoughts in isolation and have it confirmed that those thoughts are meaningful and significant? So by conducting myself in this style, it was underlined to me that there is a significant difference between learning something from someone else and learning something yourself. One outweighs the other, and it's not even close. When you yourself have and know all the building blocks of your thoughts, your conclusions, the value of that end product is far greater. It's far better than having to work backwards and having to grasp for things that maybe aren't even relevant. It's far better not having to look backwards to vet whatever building blocks to see if they support your thoughts or conclusions. People seem to feed into a range of cognitive biases doing this, and it certainly produces plenty of pseudo-intellectuals. Just what the world needs more of. And let's take a moment here to think about that in the context of current world, current year. One of the big problems, as I see it, is that people relinquish their intellectual autonomy now more than ever and adopt the thoughts of others, often blindly and more as we go. The world turning into right or correct by popularity. I mean, maybe it always was this way, but it's an extremely dangerous state of affairs, in my view. And, you know, we see this all the time. A person who has adopted a position, I don't know, just because it feels good, but can't justify or rationalize their position. Such a person is inherently irrational. This is a subject I will be talking about more in future. Maybe not a lot, but very precisely, I hope. Digression aside, let's circle back to the subject of deprogramming. I realized somewhere along the way that a part of my deprogramming method also serves as a good basis for ripping the guts. It serves to establish a foundation to build other thoughts upon, which is what we're doing here, building thoughts and having a laugh. So when I do this spiritual psychotherapy, particularly deprogramming, my first goal is to get people thinking for themselves. That is the very first goal, and it's critical, as it's the first step in opening and unlocking the mind. And I'm all about self-empowerment. I want people to realize their full power and to evolve as beings. Thinking for oneself is foundational in helping people to understand themselves, helping people understand where their thoughts come from and why they make the choices they do. Because we're all programmed by society, right? Some more than others. I personally have been on the outside of society my entire life, but this affords me a great deal of intellectual and spiritual freedom and enables me the ability to reach uncommon conclusions and perspectives. Something we'll talk more about later, I'm sure. So the very first thing I do is help people understand how their thoughts are formed, where their thoughts come from, and help them identify what thoughts are in service of others, in service of society, in service of some harmful entity even, and help them understand what thoughts are pure, let's say. What thoughts bring them closer to, God maybe? And that's a judgment call, right? This is based on perception. And what we're about to talk about will clarify what I think about good and evil, right and wrong, good and bad. I mean, perhaps it will, perhaps it won't. I don't know, but we'll try. So the very first thing I do, and because this is rip the guts, there's no gentle approach now. No need to tread carefully, be respectful, gradually peel back the layers of the onion as I would when leading someone in the deprogramming process one-on-one. We're not going to bother with any of that now. We're going to go straight in and rip the guts out of the matter. So, what do you call reality? How do you define it? The question of the ages, right? The question mankind has been asking for more than 1 trillion of years. What is, how, and why? The question of the ages. This is the space that is normally filled by philosophy and religion and, addiction, abuse, anger, rage. The question of the ages. And the one that, I'm going to say, is responsible for all human suffering and misery. Because one way or another, this question causes people the most amount of distress. The question you may not ask yourself, but the one that, if answered, solves all of life's problems. Humanity has, of course, perhaps necessarily, glazed over this issue because people do, after all, want a very ordered conception of reality in order to build life upon. People want and think they need that very ordered and rational world, a framework they can operate within because they don't want unpredictability. It's frightening. A calm and stable world is of the most comfort to people. Move pieces around for some decades, reproduce and die. Throw in a bit of strife, a few laughs, pleasure and pain along the way, and that's your human experience. Done and done. And thank God it was ordered and rational. Thank God you didn't color outside the lines. But what if there's more? I've seen more than that, and I've shown others more than that. And to me, it seems insane to exist and not explore existence. You might be surprised what's possible. People especially like predictability, though. They like the order. They want to operate the world and have the results they expect come about. This is, of course, often a cause of friction in human interaction, and especially in my case where, as an uncommon person, I am not predictable to the doe-eyed automatons of the world. And that's frightening to some, most even. People do, of course, fear that which they do not understand. This seems to me to be one of the most common human attributes, and this accounts for some of the force that wants people to be homogenized. And in my experience, it's uncomfortable for, I don't know, many or most to exist in the moment in unpredictable situations instead of having ordered and predictable experiences where they can simply play out their programming. It's uncomfortable. And I think deep down, on some level, it's uncomfortable not knowing. I find most often that when I challenge a person to exist in the moment, to exist unrestrained, they don't like it. They crave the order. People are adverse to these situations because instead of playing out their programming, they're forced to do one of two things usually. Lash out, fight back against the discomfort as a defense, or actually engage. Cast off the shackles of programming and engage. And that's rarer than you might think. And, you know, this is a nice little experiment I've run often as a filter, you know, testing the fences, seeing how resistant a person is to change, to growth, evolution, uncommon experience. It's for these reasons that when conducting deprogramming, I have a preamble, which is basically where I say, you might feel attacked by questions I ask or things I say, but if you trust the process, you'll see I'm not trying to hurt you. And I found this to be quite necessary, as deprogramming can be harsh. And since I'm not in it for the money, there's no need to jerk someone around, try to milk them for, you know, as much money as I can, as some therapists certainly do, because, of course, they're financially incentivized to have patients return. And as I'm not a by-the-hour therapist, my approach is a little sharper, a little more to the point. Some of the reasons people seek deprogramming is to alleviate symptoms of broken or harmful frameworks. And remember, I'm harping on this subject because I realize that a part of my method for deprogramming works well as the basis for ripping the guts. When I talk about frameworks, what I'm talking about is the framework of reality a person has been programmed with, be that self-programming or, more commonly, society's programming. So the core of the issue really is this question: what is reality? How do you define it? What, where, why, how? This is at the core of so many issues, and especially when a person is marching to the beat of society's drum and things are a bit pear-shaped. When a person has never spent the time to understand for themselves, when they've never come to their own intrinsic understanding or conception of reality, most are simply living out their programming. And when the programming is broken or incomplete, the being malfunctions. And, you know, you can scale that up. You can take that from a single individual to your neighborhood, your city, your country, and the species. I believe the species is severely malfunctioning. And look, as an aside, it's worth acknowledging here that you can wind up in the weeds thinking about this for an entire lifetime, multiple lifetimes even. You can get lost in the minutiae forever and still never guess correctly what's really going on, what reality and existence is. People have, of course, made careers out of exploring these questions about existence. And there's surely 9 billion books written on the subject by countless humanoids since the written word was developed. Humans, though, have a long history of attacking people that think for themselves, people that challenge the status quo by delving deeper into existence. People have been suppressed, ostracized, imprisoned, and murdered over the matter countless times. I myself have been attacked for it. So, what's the point in any of it if you will most likely never understand reality? And even if you did happen to guess correctly, improbable as that may be, you'll probably never be able to prove it to anyone else or yourself, and especially since everything you know, aka think you know, somewhere in it contains an assumption. And an assumption is all it takes to invalidate what you know. So, knowing nothing at all what's the point in any of this? Opening and unlocking the mind. And while I loathe asserting or declaring anything to be fact, because I do, of course, want you to think for yourself most of all, I'm happy to assert that there is a lot more going on than humans commonly believe or acknowledge. And we get closer to knowledge and understanding these things by unlocking the mind, by casting off the shackles of programming, killing mental parasites, and being free to think and to explore what's beyond. Speaking of mental parasites, spiritual parasites, I believe organized religion is the cancer of humanity. I believe this species has matured enough to no longer need organized religion. We've outgrown its usefulness, and it's no longer fit for purpose. And its purpose, of course, has primarily been uniformity, social control, and engineering. And again, there's probably countless books written on this subject, written on the ways religion was designed for this purpose. I've not read a single one of these books myself, couldn't even name one, because it's always been obvious to me that religion has been designed and used as a tool for controlling people. It produces uniformity and enforces conformity. The goals of organized religion are invariably betrayed by the glaring carrot and stick measures built into them. Such as, you know, all those who believe get to go to heaven, and so on. And that's not to say that organized religion hasn't been a good thing throughout history. In fact, a great many cultures have used the manipulation through religion to rise up grand and powerful societies, to increase their strength and dominion, and to build empires even. Religion has played an important role in shaping behavior, of course, stopping people from doing things that we almost universally agree are bad, stealing and casually murdering others, for instance. But remember, murder's okay so long as it's in the name of God. The irony is not lost on me, and not lost on many, many others, as it seems to me that one of the more common anti-religious themes, you see, is killing for religion. Religion has long been the glue that has held groups of people together, but I believe it's outlived its usefulness now. It's outlived its purpose. And especially in the West now, that God is dead and we have the new gods. Money and self-worship, the various ego states and lust for the material, the total rejection of the spiritual in favor of dollars and cents and the world of things. I find it fascinating to examine the interactions between a society's religion and the sovereign, the monarch, the ruling entity, whatever shape that takes. What's most fascinating is where the occasions where sometimes, you know, the sovereign runs the religion, and sometimes the religion runs the sovereign. Sometimes one blackmails the other into doing its bidding, even. Looking at the often symbiotic relationship between these two entities is fascinating and telling. One needing the other to survive, which produces all these weird and wonderful dynamics, I find this part of humanity to be very fascinating. And again, this is surely the subject of countless books and a part of many historical accounts. The shame, though, is that we only know so much. What we do know, though, is, and look, again, I don't want to assert or declare things because ultimately I want you to think for yourself and come to whatever conclusions you like. But for the sake of efficiency of communication, I will, as I'm about to do from time to time, assert some things just to keep moving along. I hope that you'll hold in your mind that I'm not trying to convince you of anything, not trying to force my framework of reality upon you or have you take on any of my conclusions. I'm not trying to tell you this or that is. More than anything else, I'm expressing myself for the sake of expression. So, what we do know is, through the study of the various interactions between the sovereign, the ruling entity of a society, and the dominant religion in that society is that the word of God is really just the word of man. Examples of where all of a sudden the word of God changes or gets reinterpreted to suit the religious body are everywhere and very easy to find. Even when the shift from one interpretation to another takes decades or generations, we can see a conscious human effort to make that shift. This is often done to maintain primacy, to keep from isolating a portion of the population, or to roll back certain things that previously served to isolate some. And all because they would get less money, they would be less relevant, they would have less power and less control. This is how you know that the word of God is really just the word of man. Of course, in the West, we have the separation of church and state now, for good reason, and certainly for some reasons related to what I'm talking about here. And, you know, the West is now just a hodgepodge of all the world's religions, the cancerous scabs that cause problem upon problem. Organized religion has outlived its usefulness. And especially in the case of entities like the Catholic Church. And don't get me wrong, I know that religion does serve some spiritual purpose for a great many. But all these, you know, Islamic and Christian entities like the Catholic Church do more harm than good, in my view. I am absolutely all for spirituality. I'm just dead against organized religion, and I believe it's important to make the distinction between spirituality, spiritual movements, and the entities that organize and run these things. Because after all, the word of God really is just the word of man. And all this coming from someone whose ancestors were certainly Christian at times, were definitely pagan at times, but I believe these spiritual social clubs do far more harm than good on a deeper level. And I'm not just talking about all the division, the hatred, the killing, the wars. I'm talking about the state of the soul. I actually think it's probably lazy to simply take on the beliefs of others, to be indoctrinated. And yes, I understand that in this modern world where no one has the time to be human anymore, it's the easy way to go, to take that religious pill, like Christianity, that says, it's all okay and it's all fine and God loves you and everything's forgiven. And you get to go to heaven and all the rest, right? So you take the pill and, well, that's a load off. Got those existential questions all squared away and, yep, I'm going to heaven and that exists and everything's fine, etc. You get your spiritual social club membership card and that leaves you a whole lifetime to focus on grinding away and chasing those little gratifications or whatever. I feel that this is an extremely lazy way to go, chasing a carrot into oblivion. And to me, the personal exploration of existence is fundamental to existence itself. It's been a joy for me, personally, to explore the universe, to explore consciousness, reality, to ask the existential questions, to explore everything. And this is a podcast about everything, right? So, we've established that foregoing the personal exploration of existence is lazy and even harmful, in my view, and that I feel as though organized religion has outlived its purpose. And we could discuss the good and bad of religion until the cows come home, but that's a tiresome subject. And I imagine there are hundreds and thousands of books written on the subject. People have undoubtedly dedicated massive amounts of time and thought power to studying religion and analyzing the virtues of religion. People have dedicated themselves to discussing the pros and cons of religion and made careers out of it, of course. And this is one of the places where people have been harmed for thinking. Harmed for thinking and expressing their thoughts, one of the more repugnant, vile, and disgusting human behaviors. And one that seems to be human nature, as this behavior occurs across all cultures and through all time. sticking with beating up on the Catholic Church. The Inquisition is an easy example. And God only knows how many people have been murdered for heresy, apostasy, foul to the nth degree. The Catholic Church has, of course, never been shy about hurting people in God's name, never been shy about suppressing free thought and science. Catholic Church is a pretty good one for that. All the little or big defense mechanisms built into almost every religion of that type betray the fact that the Word of God really is just the Word of man. Another facet of the subject we could discuss until the cows come home, but why would we? That's boring. We can actually just assert it and take it to be true that most religions defend themselves by hurting people, by hurting individuals and collections of individuals that undermine the religion, and sometimes by simply existing. Religious organizational entities such as the Catholic Church certainly have done a lot of harm to preserve their power and control, to preserve their fragile belief systems. You might justify these things by saying something like, it's all for the greater good, but there's also greater harm involved. So I did just mention the suppression of science, for instance. In order to preserve that which they hold so dear, they are quite happy to hold back the entire species, to slow down, dampen, or stop advancement entirely, and all to preserve power and control, and to defend what really are fragile beliefs. And again, we can say that the vigorous and bellicose ways these entities defend themselves really does betray their goals, their intentions, and, sorry to say, the fragility of their beliefs. No intelligent, rational, sane person can ever say that organized religion does no harm. So, as religions debase themselves by changing and reinterpreting the so-called Word of God to suit their needs, something that has happened many, many times and through many, many religions, it makes it very hard to respect a belief system or its followers when this behavior is so prominent. Imagine it, you're a follower of whatever religion, let's say Catholicism, just while we're talking about it, and your religion has done all of this. It's persecuted people, suppressed science, and reinterpreted the Word of God to serve its needs, and all the rest. Do you really respect yourself? Do you really think it's fine, good even, to harm people, to harm the species overall? Do you really just go, you're right, everything is fluid and changing, and we can just reinterpret and make words mean something else whenever we like? Funnily enough, though, that's a trend in Western society at the moment, a trend where good words get ruined and destroyed by their misuse. And look, let's talk about language for a moment. Language is a tool for communication, right? And in my view, words are at their best when they have precise definitions, because this increases the effectiveness of communication. I don't even think any two humans have ever spoken the same language, so it's critically important that you communicate as precisely as possible, so that the interpretation of your communication is as close as possible to what you actually meant. That should be the goal of all language-based communication, I would think. I believe English is a fantastic tool for this purpose. I'm biased, of course, but it just might be the most effective and efficient tool humans have ever developed. I can't know that, of course, without knowing all languages, but it seems pretty damn good to me. Pretty damn good until people start misusing words, forcing words to have fuzzy definitions. And yes, I know, English is a living language and it evolves. Words take on new meanings, new words get created, and so on. But the misuse of some words and total destruction of others makes communication less precise, makes communication weaker. You'll note this ugly little activity is rife in socio-political rhetoric. And that's a subject I certainly will be talking about more in future. I'll also go into more depth on language, and my saying, no two humans have ever spoken the same language, may stand out to you in particular. That might sound a little kooky on its face, but an explanation will follow, just not at this moment. For now, though, we're going to continue laying the foundation. It may seem a bit gratuitous to beat up on religion so much, and don't get me wrong, I'm extremely pro-spirituality. I'm just anti-organized religion. And there is a point to all of this, so let's circle back to this question. The question of the ages. What is reality? When you understand the fact, the perhaps unfortunate fact, that reality is probably impossible to understand, you must acknowledge that we only exist and cooperate by what you would loosely call consensus, right? We agree on certain things, or try to at least, out of necessity. This is the basis for human organization and cooperation. The fact is, though, that no one knows what reality is. No one knows there is a God, and no one knows the nature of that God. And anyone that claims to know what existence, reality, or God is really just full of it. Absolutely, to the bone, full of it. We only operate in the way we do by agreement. And on the macro scale, there's no tangible basis for any of it. We agree or try to agree that this is or that is, and this forms, you know, the shared framework for reality that we base our lives upon. When we understand and fully take on the fact that we don't actually know what the universe or reality is, we find some serious implications, right? Implications on things like morality, because we only have good and bad, good and evil, right and wrong, by agreement. That is problematic, as they say, because you don't actually know and know nothing objectively that you can build a framework of reality upon. You can never be absolutely certain that you are correct, or that anyone else is, for that matter. You could actually say that everything just is. There is no good and bad, right or wrong. Might start to look a little like nihilism at some point. And again, obviously, this would have been, for the longest time, the concern of philosophers and religion people. Because it's a real quandary, right? You don't actually know. And that said, everything you know or think you know, somewhere in it, has at least one assumption. And that assumption invalidates what you know or think you know. In my practice, I've brought people to understanding this fact, and I've been surprised that people didn't understand it to begin with, and even more surprised that people find it truly frightening. I find it liberating personally, but this fact is truly scary for some people, and I've often wondered if it's something that gnaws at the mind, something that makes people uneasy. Because if you've ever practiced logic, this conclusion is inescapable. And since most humans employ logic, I wonder if this fact is floating around there somewhere in the mind. Like I said, causing uneasiness, gnawing away. This might just be my wishful thinking, though. Thinking that others have spent any time at all doing their homework when, in my experience, I know that isn't the case. I see the evidence for that every single day. Helping people to understand this and its implications is one of the tools I use in my spiritual psychotherapy. And in developing methods for things like deprogramming, I've learned a lot about people. I've learned some good techniques and some hard lessons when helping to lift the veil of ignorance. For instance, you know, in my early days of practice, it could be said that I was pretty gung-ho in my approach, not yet understanding that some people really are fragile. In those days, I even collapsed a couple of minds with my hard and fast approach, where instead of being gentle, slowly peeling back the layers, I ripped the guts right out of the house of cards that constitutes the mind. Forever surprised that this foundational thought can be so devastating to a person. And we know why, right? It's mostly because some people are so invested in their reality framework, usually the common framework, and usually without understanding or acknowledging it's all just based on thin air. It's hard to accept, and some people don't. In fact, it's extremely common for people to fight back against this fact, violently even, all because they've invested so much into so little, and they can't stand the idea that perhaps it was all wrong. Sunk cost fallacy starts to play, and they double down, which is why the slow and gentle approach is now best by test. Now, I find that describing the mind as a house of cards is quite appropriate, as all you have to do is undermine the foundation and the whole structure collapses. And that's what we're talking about here, because everything you know or think you know has an assumption in it. Therefore, an intelligent person would know they know nothing. I know nothing. That said, and while we're talking about religion, all humans are fundamentally faith-based entities. So take theism and atheism, for example. Now, I see both of these things as being equivalent. On one side, you have this faith that there is a god or gods, and on the other, you have faith that there is no god. So, in my view, these are equivalent because both sides are simply believing one thing or the other without any evidence. Of course, there are many infantile arguments that get made on both sides, but that's all they are, arguments. And again, people make careers out of arguing this subject. But they know nothing. I know nothing, and you know nothing. And I personally think that the only logical position, the only position I respect, is agnosticism. And I find it really hard to believe in a person's intelligence when they're anything but. That is a little unfair, of course, and especially since I've known many fairly intelligent theists and atheists. It's a little bewildering to find a reasonably intelligent person who has a firm position on this matter. So I believe agnosticism is the only logical and rational position. And this coming from someone who has had a great many really far out experiences, a person who could easily see God in some of the indescribable interactions with what I will clumsily describe as energy, forces, beings that are otherworldly. Through all that I've seen and all that I've experienced, I can certainly make a case for the existence of God. Still, I think that you can't know. I think there's no end to questions and no way for humans to imagine things beyond what they have the building blocks for already. Try it. Go ahead and imagine something. I'll wait. Was what you imagined made up of things you already know? Was it made up of the colors and shapes, sights and sounds you're already familiar with? Did you build it from things you already know? I'll take that as a yes. This may actually be a way to validate experiences, because when I say that I've had experiences with things that are indescribable, I can also say that I didn't imagine them, as they weren't made up of anything I knew before, and I have no words to describe them. In fact, the closest word we have is the word God, funnily enough. That said, everything I know, I had to experience for the very first time at some point. It's just curious to experience things that consist of nothing previously known. So all you strict theists out there, don't get your pantaloons in a bunch over my anti-religious rhetoric. I do accept that a god or gods may exist, I just think you can never know for sure. I believe God will forever be beyond human conception, and I believe it's foolhardy and harmful to ever assert that God exists. And more than anything else, my gripe is with organized religion. Now, back to reality. I think human existence is like the television series Lost, if you've ever seen it. You start off, you don't know what's going on, you're trying to figure things out, and you've got all these problems that you're trying to solve, and then there's a mystery, and you have all these questions. What's that? Why is that? What's going on? You solve that mystery, then you find out it didn't really change much or wasn't really that important, but wait a minute, there's another mystery. And you have all these other questions to answer and all these other things to figure out, and on it goes. I don't see there being an end to that. I don't see there being an end to questions. Humans are, of course, making progress in solving some of the mysteries that the universe has presented us, but I don't ever see there being an end to the mysteries of existence. There are always more questions. Okay, so let's think about something basic here. Let's say that one day we find out there is a god or gods, and those gods created the universe, etc. Okay, but what created God? God just magically came into existence, right? How? And do you really expect us to take your word for it, God? And so you see, there's a big problem here, right? And even if you find out, okay, there's this thing that created God, and there's this thing that magically happened which created God, okay, how and why? I just don't see it personally, an end to questions. I don't ever see being satisfied with any answers, because there are always more questions, no matter what, and never one answer that could satisfy me to the point where there are no questions left. And that's fine. It's actually super fine, because imagine if you knew the nature of the universe. Imagine if you knew exactly what was going on and where everything came from. Then all your choices are really easy from there, right? Everything is laid out before you. I've actually written extensively on this subject in the past, theorizing about the universe, that is, amongst other things. But let's just pull something out for the sake of furthering the point. Let's just say the whole purpose of existence is to work toward and eventually achieve putting the universe back together. The existence of everything is there trying to put itself back together, working towards eventually collapsing the universe back down to, you know, an infinitely small point, and then there's another big bang, and the cycle repeats again, infinitely. Of course, some of that thought's products are that you'll exist an infinite amount of times, and there'll be, you know, an infinite amount of versions of yourself, also an infinite amount of instances where you don't exist at all, and this will just keep going over and over again. You'll exist in this moment again. You'll exist in this moment again with one more hair on your head, one less. And you'll live this exact life an infinite amount of times. And you'll live out every single possibility an infinite amount of times, and so on. All the permutations of arrangements of matter will happen, have happened, and will happen again an infinite amount of times. Right or wrong, doesn't matter. It's a thought. The point is that if you knew that, if we knew for sure, then everything becomes very simple and very boring. Because you know the ultimate goal, you know what you have to do, and you know it's inevitable, one way or another. Imagine if this thought was true, and we knew it. Of course, the thoughts that stem from this are vast and complex, but one stands out to me here and now, because it's funny, and this is a comedy podcast. The thought is that you'd have people killing themselves everywhere and all the time. Things get tough, okay, let's roll the dice on another life, see what we get. I am, of course, glazing over the complexity of that thought's products, just to keep things moving, but still, it's a fun toy to play with. So anyway, all that aside, I think that life being a mystery is probably a good thing. I would be extremely bored if there was a very clear goal that we had as a species. Of course, we have all these little ticky-tack goals on the way to colonizing the solar system, the galaxy, the universe, intergalactic warfare, and all this exciting stuff to keep us occupied. And there are so many ways to think, so many possibilities, and I would like to explore this further in future episodes, absolutely, as this is a subject I enjoy, but not the main point of this episode. What we're really talking about here is the first step in unlocking the mind. And you know, that's a hard thing to say because I don't want to assume anything about you, dearest listener. I'm simply employing some of the devices I've used in my spiritual practice to build a foundation for this podcast. Okay, so, what is reality? Well, looks like you can't define it. Okay, so, what is the meaning of life? Well, looks like you don't know, and bad news, no one else knows either. It's only by what you could loosely describe as agreement that we based our conception of reality upon. No one knows a thing, and that's actually very true. And anyone that claims to know a thing obviously just wants something from you. And by the way, I don't want anything from you. This podcast is a form of expression, and it's expression for expression's sake. And, you know, see what happens, right? I'm not trying to convince you of anything, and I don't want anything. I just want to express myself, and if I can make someone think or laugh or smile, then that would be a delightful byproduct. Okay, so now that we're unlocking, and we could spend a lot of time on this point, and especially discussing the interesting element of understanding that everything you think is based on an assumption, especially talking about the implications on things like morality. It's a very, very interesting subject. And again, probably since man could think, people were thinking about this sort of thing. The subject of philosophy and religion since forever. So we could talk about all that and we could get really bogged down on the subject. And it's worth thinking about. But, you know, for our purposes, it's only worth thinking about to the point where you have a firm grasp, a foundational understanding of what I've been saying. And again, I don't want to assume anything about you. You might already have a great grasp on all of this. It's just something that, in today's societies, no one seems to spend that much time thinking about. It isn't a feature in people's arguments, in people's logic, if you can call it that. Because you don't want to get bogged down asking the existential life questions that, you know, that probably all humans should ask themselves and seek to understand. In my view, people are better when they understand, and in my experience, people are better equipped for existence when they do. And, you know, it's always better to explore for yourself, to seek natural understandings. And I'm all about, as I said earlier, and you know, it's a buzzword now. It's a money word. I'm all about having organic experiences and gaining knowledge organically. So I encourage everyone to seek, to quest. But of course, we can't all do that, apparently, because society wants you to keep your head down and grind away. There are also some pitfalls to questing, of course, some traps that people commonly fall into. For instance, I've had some very far out experiences. I've seen indescribable things. I've interacted with energies or entities that some would surely attribute to God. And through all this, I've always been able to put my feet back on the ground. Some people have similar experiences, learn the same or similar things, journey to the center of the universe as I have, and start calling themselves prophets, start claiming that they are somehow special. And you know, if you're a prophet, you're there to profit, right? But I say to you that no one is special. Absolutely no one. I've never met a special person, and I've never been a special person, as far as I know. The way I like to look at it is that there are only degrees of rarity. Rarity in experiences, abilities, knowledge. But does that make you special? Not as far as I can tell. And I believe that what one human is capable of, most other humans are too. Of course, the caveat is that, you know, people do have limitations. A quadriplegic isn't going to win Olympic gold for pole vaulting, for example. I also have a few things to say about cognitive limits. But when it comes to spiritual experiences, I encourage people to quest for themselves. I don't believe I've had any experiences that you can't. And while our interpretations, knowledge acquisition, ability development may differ, I believe the experiences are universally available. I also believe that these experiences are vital. They help to break down the imposed, perceived limitations that people are programmed with. And that's essential in freeing yourself to explore everything. This is the way to developing abilities that the common folk would have you believe aren't real, aren't possible. Often, that belief comes from a point of envy. And it's quite common, in my experience, for someone who is locked in playing the game to absolutely hate the free. When a mind slave sees someone who is free to think and to be, they hate. And people are especially ugly when you have and they have not. So go with caution. This is a bigger subject that I will delve into in future, so stay tuned. My point is, though, that getting from where you are to where you want to be, or to where someone else is or has been, is a matter of effort. It's a matter of energy expenditure. If I can come to communicate with, let's say, energy or entities that don't exist or are irrational or whatever, I believe you can too. Because I'm not special, right? And here's another pitfall of the journey. I've known people who have had, you know, certain spiritual experiences and got to certain places, and a lot of people get stuck on things like megalomania, pour themselves into ego, get stuck on the belief that they themselves are God, and you know what? You can't actually prove that that's not true, though. For example, I can't even prove that I'm not the only one that exists. I could be imagining this entire world, or the thought, you know, this mind-bending thought, apparently that's very in vogue right now, it could all be a simulation. Yes, it could be, absolutely. And now you're thinking. There shouldn't be a mind-blowing thought for anyone, as it's only a product of the fundamental understanding that you know nothing. You don't know a thing. You don't know the nature of reality, the meaning of life, and we only organize ourselves the way we do by agreement, the loose agreement that forms this shared reality framework. So, there are many ways you can think. You know, like, from my perspective, you exist because I've at least imagined you and everything has come from me, which would make me God. These are just some of the ways you can think, should you choose. And, you know, impossible to invalidate, but some of the ways you can think, should you so choose. I've met people who have had experiences similar to mine, come to certain knowledge and understanding and get hooked, stuck on the belief that feeds the ego. I am God in all creation, blah, 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 blah. Again, just a choice you can make, if you like. I believe this is likely just a phase of intellectual and spiritual evolution, a phase that some people choose not to evolve beyond or are otherwise incapable of evolving beyond. I actually consider myself lucky that I never got stuck there, as many do. And especially after gaining so much knowledge and many abilities, going to certain places and seeing certain things, I think I'm lucky as I already had a predisposition for feeding my ego as, you know, in my young adulthood, I was extremely good at something, extremely successful at it, and I had a massively inflated ego because of it. The very first thing I did, though, when starting on my journey of spiritual awakening, was to let all the air out of my ego. Doing this enabled me to evolve past the point where I could get stuck on things like megalomania or on thinking I'm in some way special, as opposed to simply being someone who has willed themselves to uncommon experiences and sought knowledge and put the time and effort in to get there. I think this type of thing is less common now because society requires you to believe what it wants you to believe. Society needs you to not think for yourself. It needs you to be a cog in the machine. It needs you to agree and to believe in its system, its framework of reality. It doesn't want you to get bogged down thinking for yourself. It wants you to play the game. It wants you to spend your life moving pieces around. It wants you to produce, and it never ever wants you to discover or explore the nature of your existence. To explore reality and spirituality, it doesn't want you to do these things. They are surplus to its needs. It will, you know, it'll give you enough rope so you can dabble in this and that and the other thing, but it will never give you the freedom to decide things for yourself, to quest for yourself, to think for yourself, as doing so is a threat to the machine. And speaking of questing, it always amuses me to see all these Westerners that escape and go to various other parts of the world, other ethnic groups to sample and explore their various spiritual practices. I've met a bunch of people who've done this in search of answers, meaning. They travel around sampling various spiritual flavors, various means of divination, when, in actual fact, everything they ever needed is within themselves. Of course, there's more to be had from the experience, but when one is seeking answers this way, one is looking in the wrong places. All you need to do is look within. It's also worth noting here the convergence of thought and spiritual practice in isolation. I did just happen to become a shaman and without even knowing what a shaman was, after all. The convergence of spiritual practice in isolation. This tells me there's something to it. And that's one of the more rational arguments I can make. So really, all people are shopping for when they do this spiritual tourism is cultural flavor, right? Through the convergence of spiritual practice, I can happily say to you that you don't need to go to, you know, South America to do ayahuasca or the temples of Asia to burn incense. I mean, you can if you want, and it's probably a lot of fun, but if what you're searching for is spiritual evolution, you're taking the long way round. I do understand the attraction, though, the will to escape, because in the West, God is dead, right? And we have the new gods, money and self. We have self-worship and the ego. So good. We love to worship ourselves. We love to worship material. We love the ego self and the world of things. And all this to distract you from the understanding of what's really going on, to distract you from understanding what might actually be, on a deeper level, important. And again, I can't make any claims about what is or isn't important. I can only speak to my own experience, and I can only say what isn't important within my reality framework. Celebrity and self-worship don't matter. Money and material don't matter. And, you know, with the advent of the pocket computer and the endless photograms posted on the internet, the endless attention-seeking and virtue signaling, none of it matters. The exponential growth of ego is gross. Spirituality's death spiral. And what a shame it's all based on nothing. And yes, I understand much of it is in furtherance of the great biological imperative. But I'm sorry to tell you, your life is fleeting, probably. It comes and it goes. And what have you done? Anything more than push your genes forward in time and space? And does that even matter anyway? And did that even happen? We're going to get into these types of questions and offshoots of this subject in future episodes because it all comes from that base reality, right? The framework. It all stems from this foundation we've been establishing. What is reality? What is, how, and why? And what are the implications of these questions? Insane. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-opening to think about all the things that come from the understanding that there is nothing you can say for sure. Then you have to start believing in things, right? Literally everything. And what does that mean? Well, this is the game we're all playing, right? This is the game of humans trying to figure this all out, trying to improve the consensus. But in actual fact, what humans are really trying to improve, according to my observations, is this thing that I was talking about before. Humans have been trying to improve and perfect this power and control structure that I was talking about before, right? This is what we're really trying to improve here. The creation of the perfect Ponzi scheme. The total mental, physical, and spiritual subjugation of the species. We're not focused on improving our understanding of existence, let's say. Here and there, yeah, sure, through science, you know, we're discovering the laws of the universe and improving our mastery. We're discovering what is and what isn't and finding out new stuff all the time. And sure, that's great, but that's not the primary focus of people. The primary focus of people is the same as it's always been. How do we control them? Others. How do we control all others? I'm a person, I want to control all other people. I want everyone else to think what I want them to think. Not like I do. I don't want them to think like I do. I want them to think what I want them to think so I can control and manipulate them and get what I want for me from them. And what people want for themselves is, most often, power and control.